Greetings again, everyone. I guess I'm supposed to wear this. Probably at one time or another, all of you here have had people who owed you money but refused to pay. Jack's first one to nod. He's a salesman, and he goes out and sells things, and sometimes on the shake of a hand or a signing on the dotted line, people are supposed to pay, and he delivers the goods, and then it begins to become sometimes a problem. Well, in life and in the church, we have opportunity to exercise responsibility and be responsible for decisions that we make, for tasks that we are asked to accomplish, to be honest, to be trustworthy, to be faithful as an individual. At the Feast of Tabernacles, every year, we know that one individual is assigned as a festival elder. And of course, it's all sort of magic for me. You realize how much I depend on those festival elders. Ron and I, of course, with input from others in the ministry and those in the ministerial council, etc. We write out letters, we find out where all the ministers are going to be, and we go over a list of those that are going to be in Guntersville or Branson or whatnot, and we try to assign the various sermons and sermonettes with, of course, an eye toward who can best help and serve and inspire the people, not whose ego can we please. And we know that we're going to hurt some feelings. We know that when that list goes out, there are going to be a few men that are used to preaching, sometimes quite a number of times per year, and because of the festival, they won't even see their names there. They might be a little bit disappointed. But there are an incredible number of events to take care of. When we go up and look at a festival site, as we did recently in Cincinnati, and that decision is not yet made, we're going to want some input from people along the way, and I might announce that now so they can be thinking about it, that north of Cincinnati, about 30 miles, is a place called King's Island. It's not really an island. It's a resort with a huge park, a miniature replica, the Eiffel Tower, everything you might expect in an amusement park, including the huge circular-type roller coasters and all the concessions and rides for little children. Beautiful camping area. The one drawback is it is right near the crossing of an interstate and a major highway, but it has a feeling of being in the country. There are big, beautiful hardwood trees. It'll be lovely in the fall of the rolling Ohio hills, and in 1 or 2 minutes you're out in the cornfields and the Ohio countryside. The National Football Hall of Fame is right near there. And within about 30 minutes, you can drive down to Cincinnati for some of the real great restaurants in the entire Ohio Valley. You're not too many miles away from the Wright-Patterson Air Force Museum, which even has the X-15, the old X-1, replicas of Little Boy and Big Boy, the first two atomic bombs. And I think the original Enola Gay is parked indoors in that big building, the B-29 that actually dropped the world's first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Other aircraft, such as the old F-100 series, the F-86, some of the old World War II aircraft, and so on, including some of the old obsolete bombers, and I think there's at least one of the old B-47s, some of the obsolete ones like a B-36. It's really a fabulous place to go see if you've never been there. But we're still looking at that. We have to take into account elderly people and altitude and traffic, and whether you're going to have adequate units with kitchens and kitchenettes, and the price range, and the time of the year, and all of this type of thing. But basically, it isn't my responsibility. I just get to go to the feast like anybody else, but I'm scheduled to speak. So when I go up to Guntersville, I'll probably expect there'll be a lot of our own people running around. They will have been there ahead of time. My room will be ready for me. Somebody will meet me and say, oh yes, here you are, here's the key to your room. And I really depend upon other people having all of that done and looking to all of those details. In little minor ways, annoyances in our lives, I remember in one rather protracted series of occasions when an individual would say, yes, I will be there, or I will see you there, and he became almost known to me as being completely undependable. He would say, I'll be there. He wouldn't be there. You could almost depend upon him not being there. Now, maybe you've met people like that. I loaned quite a sum of money one time, almost in tears, to a gentleman. I won't belabor that, but he wanted to borrow it from the church. I said, I can't loan you money from the church. Those people send that money in here in good faith for me to spend it on radio and television and the printed page. Well, what about me personally? I didn't have it. Well, he was in bad, bad, bad shape, so we went down to the bank and I signed a note. And I had to pay off the note and extend the note and pay all the interest, and I never got my money. I wrote him a letter and told him how embarrassed I was to ask for that money, and I knew it hurt him to have to ask me for it, but it hurt me real bad to have to ask for it back. But that $2,500 or whatever it was the price of my friend. That's what I bought my friend for, and that's the end of my friend. I've never seen him since. I've never gotten a call from him. I've never gotten a letter from him. So I found out my friend was not responsible. You couldn't depend upon him. He wasn't honest, and he wasn't trustworthy. It was exactly like somebody walking into my home, if I had the kind of money around, sticking a gun at my temple and saying, "You will give me your money," and then walking out with my money in his wallet, because it's the same thing, except in a way, this was even worse. I would have known and understood what was going on if a robber had shown up. But when a friend hits me in desperate straits with a terrible problem in his own family, a death in the family, and a home about to be taken away from him, boy, that's when you dig down. You want to help a friend. In the church, as we learn about repentance and growth and overcoming, and we are told, and we have been told for 20 some, 30, 40 years in my case, that we are to govern and to rule, that we are to develop into governors and mayors and city managers. The women oftentimes are told, now, you need to learn to rule by ruling over your kitchen. I don't know if any woman has ever thought, as she stares at a greasy oven, or as she stares at the grease splatters on the linoleum or whatever, or the dirty pots and pans, or the old broken eggshell on the floor, and she's there trying to clean up after a whole bunch of relatives showed up unexpectedly, that this is ruling, and this gives her a feeling of authority, and that she is learning how to govern in the kingdom of God or the world tomorrow. I'm not really sure of that, but that basically is what they were told. We know that it is true, according to Revelation 3:21 and 2:26, to him that overcometh will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. How are you going to know how to govern and to rule and to accept responsibility, to be responsible to do X or Y or Z, to do it on time, to have it done and have it accomplished and have it waiting there the way you're expected to have it done when whoever asks you to do it shows up? If you've never been given that opportunity in your born days. Now, there are a lot of overtones in this that have to do with teaching, child rearing, husbands and wives and families, the church, business, a boss to an employee, giving someone responsibility. I well remember, and I'll just cite one example, Mr. Dean Wilson became a stench in the nostrils of one gentleman, and vinegar to his teeth and smoke to his eyes. This gentleman I will not name, but he was involved in the Church Administration Department of the United States. There were people that I rescued from him, and I would always send them to Canada. They were people who were too small of physical stature, who were questionable because they had an Italian-American background or a funny-sounding back name or whatever. He didn't like them because they were good bowlers or they came from the street gang in the south side of Chicago, whatever. But I thought they might have had some talent. Dean Wilson invariably took these men who were looked upon as potential failures and were suspect in the power structure in Pasadena, and he promptly put responsibility on them. He put them out and said, "You're the pastor of this church." He ordained them. He gave them things to do. He said, "Here are the parameters, your responsibility, and here's what I expect you to do." And lo and behold, these men grew in those jobs and those responsibilities. Now, it didn't make this other individual I'm talking about very pleased, but I was very pleased with the performance of Mr. Dean Wilson because he knew how to delegate. And when he was able to delegate, he was able to turn around and walk away and say, "I'm going to leave it with him. I'm not going to delegate," and then continually look over his back and chew him out and Monday morning quarterback him and second guess him and jerk the rug out from under him and take issue with every decision he makes, exactly as in some football games, some coaches will not trust the quarterback to call the plays. Other coaches will. When a quarterback gets in trouble very early in the first few downs of a game, some coaches get nervous and jerk them out of the game, and that might just totally destroy their entire career. Others realize they're excited, it's a big game, they're nervous, it's Monday night, the TV cameras are there, and 50 million Americans, including dad and mom, are watching, and they're probably a little uptight. Give them a little while to get out of it, and we saw that happen not too long ago in the Dallas Cowboys game when a substitute quarterback was put in for Danny White, struggled like mad in the first few moments of the game and came out and set a Cowboy passing record and promptly broke the all-time record of the number of receptions in one game. I'm not sure whether or not he was able to call the plays. I think I'm giving a kind of a double example there, because I think that the coach, in this case of the Dallas Cowboys, always calls the plays. But at least the quarterback was given the responsibility for carrying out the play, and he did execute it very, very well. If you are to become a yellow pencil, and if there is no such thing as responsibility, but something else entirely, how are you ever going to learn? Now, let's take that word apart for a minute. Really, if you look at the root word of sponse, it has to do with action. Response is like reflex or reaction, to react. Ability just means what it says. If you have the ability to respond, to react. Now, this is the first time in my life, by the way, I've ever preached a doctrine that isn't mentioned in the Bible. Don't look for it. The word responsibility is nowhere in the Bible. Other words are, but the word responsibility, apparently, is a comparatively new Anglo-Saxon word. In other words, about faithfulness, which is a direct synonym. Faithfulness is a good synonym. Being trustworthy, etc., good synonyms. But responsibility is not in the Bible. I saw in my lifetime, in this world, an entire nation of people, of individuals, gradually finding themselves with their personal and individual responsibility molded and melded into the will and the accountability and responsibility of just one man. I saw the collective frustrations of a nation during the time just after the Great Depression and with the rise of despotism and, of course, frantic measures to completely go it alone, so far as nation after nation reverting to a totally different economic structure to bail out starving people who were in long lines for soup and bread and potatoes and who were literally starving to death in countries all over Western Europe, England, Germany, of course, the United States, etc., in the 1930s and on into the early 1940s. The powers of Roosevelt have been analyzed time and again by some of the documentaries and some of the big network shows and motion pictures and plenty of books, that he literally had the powers of a dictator, and that the United States was very, very close, although we're not that kind of people, and I don't really think that was his goal or his aim. He needed those powers, and thankfully at that period of time was able to wield them, or the outcome of world history would have been quite different. But this was not quite the same in Nazi Germany, as the Nazis took power and took control. Without going through that entire period of time, of the fact that one madman surrounded himself with ego masseurs who only told him what his ego really wanted to hear, who then became more and more crazed with early victories and with an early organization that just seemingly could not be stopped, with marching into the lowlands and taking over all of France, and of course, as you know, marching first of all in the Rhineland, then the Sudetenland, then partitioning Czechoslovakia, and then, of course, Anschluss with Austria, and then attacking Poland, and then finally England declares war because of the attack upon Poland, and off we go into World War II. And we saw an entire nation find their frustrations and their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations channeled into the aspirations of one man. And we saw in their military structure that there was no individual except one who ultimately had the responsibility. In the war crimes trials, by the hundreds of hours, thousands of men over the span of years, and of course the Western German government has still continued to prosecute some war criminals from time to time over the years from then until now, virtually, would listen to these people trying to give the excuse for mass murder, shooting of prisoners, for reprisals against villagers because a German had been killed, the massacre at Lidice, where they put the entire citizenry of a small town inside a barn and set it on fire. And every one of them, as if with one voice, said over and over again, I was not responsible. You have to understand, I was a professional soldier, and I was merely following orders. I was ordered to do it. And if I hadn't done it, they would have stood me against the wall and shot me. Well, who was responsible? The colonel. Put the colonel on trial. I was not responsible. The general told me. Put the general on trial, like Eichmann. I was not responsible. Who was? Hitler. Oh, well, he's dead. And all of them basically said that. The idea was, be a part of this. Salute this flag. Have the chills run up and down your spine, your hair stand on end when 1,000 swastikas go by snapping in a breeze with goose-stepping jack-booted Germans, and the one that we sing here, I don't know why we still got it in the book, but they drive me nuts with it out where I live. They play the German national anthem at 5 o'clock on Friday. It's called Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken. It's called an old Austrian hymn. And for some reason, it's left in the songbook. But actually, that song is Deutschland über alles, and that's what they sing in Germany, except not those words today. The words were slightly changed during the Hitlerian era. But the idea was, this is one, it is the only one, there is nothing else like it, and it became a kind of a perverted state worship. The idea is get in line, march in step, absolve yourselves of personal responsibility, and anyone who took personal responsibility was looked upon as dangerous, pretty much singled out, oftentimes put away in a camp or killed or whatever, because they were dangerous. They weren't going to just go along with orders from on high. Now, to come back to the church for a moment and to see how this applies to us and how it is applying today, let's get a handle on criminal justice and this entire system in our country by turning to Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. There's a principle at work here that we will see. Chapter 1 of Habakkuk, if you find Daniel, Joel, Hosea, you know, Amos, Nahum, then Habakkuk, if you're looking for it in the Minor Prophets, or as some pronounce it, Habakkuk. Verse 2, O Eternal, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear? Even cry out unto thee about violence, and you don't save. Why do you show me iniquity, all of this filth and corruption going on around me, and cause me to behold grievance? Now, this I'm going to paraphrase as my prayer or my outburst to God as I watch my television set, as I see abuses among the people of God and in God's church and the parent organization, as I see something that I want to portray to you now that I didn't see but my wife told me about, but I've seen a full-length motion picture on the subject of rape. And on 2020, they apparently had an interview with a fellow who had been an attorney and then later on a judge. And basically, in some of these trials where rape has been apparently, at least allegedly, has occurred, and in these cases, there was no doubt about it because the women were actually photographed and they were showing terrible bruises and huge strangulation marks. And there's no way that that wasn't anything except a brutal assault upon a woman. And she, hysterical, distraught, is talking about this filthy brute who has practically murdered, maybe has murdered, and has raped for years and years and years and brutalized these women. Now, immediately what's happening in our so-called criminal justice system is that a bunch of old perverts called judges, a bunch of lecherous idiots called lawyers, put this poor, cowed, destroyed, vulnerable, exposed human being, who just happens to be female, up there on the witness stand, and all of them sit there, including some of the rotten, voyeuristic perverts in the jury box, and wonder if she invited it, and while it was happening, if she liked it. Yes, they do. And they ask her the kinds of questions that are calculated for them to sit there right in the courtroom and get their libidinous, silly, filthy, perverse, vicarious kicks. And they call it justice. Now, this goes on in our United States of America all the time. The worst thing that can happen to a woman in our society, especially a good-looking woman and a younger woman, is if she is raped and tries to take her attacker to trial. Because she is the one who is put on trial. And her attacker is merely one of these men who walk around, and all of the ladies are supposed to understand. that if you show this lusty beast an earlobe or a foot, he becomes a ravening maniac possessed of uncontrollable sexual lust and is probably going to attack you right where you are, and it's really your fault. It's not his fault at all. And that's the way some of these filthy old perverts, and I'll call them what they are, I don't care if they wear a judge's robe and they're called Your Honor. I sat around with about 130 of them at a golf tournament out there and heard some of the filthiest jokes I've heard in years. Listened to them take God's name in vain and talking about Jesus Christ and cussing one another out, and they were a bunch of judges. I was invited to become a part of the L.A. County Judges Golf Tournament, and there were dozens of them out there, judges and attorneys, and they are just a bunch of foul-mouthed, dirty old men that go into the profession of law and either get voted in or buy their way in or get appointed in to be a judge. I knew a J.P. in a small East Texas town who didn't even finish high school, merely owned a little gas station in a tiny town, and even putting people in jail at his own whim. And there is such a thing as redneck East Texas Deputy Sheriff Justice. And believe me, there are an awful lot of illiterate, great big gutted pompous jackasses wearing a badge out here, and I'm not against law. Nobody has spoken out more for law and order justly, fairly, and mercifully administered over the last 40 years than I have, or as many years I've been going, 28, I guess, so far as the preaching is concerned. But with that in your mind now, with what is happening, and many of you are aware of that, you see the television programs or read the books and articles on it. This prophet calls out, "Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention. Therefore the law is slacked, and judgment does never go forth." It seems like the more criminality, the less the law. The more people get away with it, the slacker the law. Now, we could see that happening in a home. Slackness in simple little things like having children keep a room clean and neat, having meals as a family and having them on time, and having where you sit down, you converse as a family. We can get to be slipshod and slack in our relationships with each other or with our families. We can be slipshod and slack, and we have been, and we are, I think, here in Tyler, about arriving to church on time, about starting services on time, about doing things decently and in order. I am not a tyrant. I haven't yet spoken out, and I'm not speaking out now about whichever little kid it was that ran along the wall in there with a crayon in his hand, left us a nice mark all the way from Benny's office to mine. But that type of thing does happen, and sometimes people arrive in the front door and the kids disappear and they don't know where in the world they are, and we've got expensive equipment, and I'm not complaining. I'm just saying, you know, realize your responsibility here in this building and so on. But really, we can see that will happen. All parties start out with, "Hi, George, how you doing? Good to see you. Come on in, Marge, how are you?" And everybody is so nice. And they sit around there just chatting the first hour till the first couple of drinks. You know, parties in homes, neighborhood parties, parties at Halloween or Christmas time. They always start formally. People sitting around are fully dressed, come with ties. Look at it about 1 o'clock in the morning, after humpteen trips to the Tom and Jerry Bowl, and look at the incredible disintegration. Well, familiarity does breed contempt, and sometimes because order and system is slacked. In this case, it says in verse 4, "Therefore the law is slack, and judgment does never go forth, and things tend to disintegrate and get very, very careless. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous." Now, have you ever read a more poignant scripture that is applicable to our society today than the fact that we have literally hundreds of thousands of retired and elderly people who live behind, I live in a community with a gate guard, and he's armed. We used to have old volunteers, but they went outside and got a security guard system, you know, some of these people that have independent security forces. And they now have armed guards at the gate. I have a back gate out near my house, which is not armed or is not even closed, but it's a little backcountry road, not too many people know about it. But mine is the first house near that gate, so that does give me a little bit of cause for concern. But there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of elderly who are terrified when they go to pick up their welfare check, because they're young thugs who know exactly where these people live, and they will prey on these women on the streets or even in their apartments. There are apartments in Detroit and Bedford-Stuyvesant and New York and Brooklyn, the Bronx, and San Francisco and L.A. and so on, where these old people who basically are terrified They live inside closed doors. They venture out for their groceries or to go to their dentist and have their bridge work worked on or to go get their welfare check, and that's about it. And they go at a certain time of the day and they avoid certain parts of their city. But there are thugs and crooks who prey upon them. And I read this and I think about every time I go into a supermarket, I know my picture is being taken. Every time I take an airplane, I walk through a metal detector and have my briefcase x-rayed. I have a big wad of keys in my pocket that has a big lump in my hip pocket that I carry to unlock everything. I realize that when I even try to pay for something with a $100 bill, and they say, could I see some identification? They wonder if it's counterfeit. I try to say, hey, lady, that's cash. I'm sorry, that's our store policy. I've got to see your driver's license to even cash a $100 bill. You think, well, what does it take? Could I see your driver's license, please? And you have to sign. In the meantime, there's even up here at the cafeteria right here in town, every day when we go through there, 2-3 times a week, we eat at the cafeteria. There's video taking my picture. You go in the bank, there are videos taking your pictures. There are these round mirrors that are positioned so a clerk can actually look around a corner, as it were, way down the aisles in supermarkets to see these women who come in looking like they're pregnant, that are not really. They got a great big overcoat, they're going out with a turkey for Thanksgiving. And they even train their kids how to do it. People come in with big overcoats and go out with these hooks laden with all kinds of things, from ham to chicken hanging underneath. And shoplifting is a multi, I guess, $100 million or $1 billion business in the United States. You turn in a car with 90,000 miles on it, go down and buy it back, got 23,000 miles on it. And that is very common, and there have been whole, again, exposés on television that show that really, as God says in the Bible, there is none that doeth justice. There is none that is honest or wise. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. The wicked doth compass about the righteous. The righteous are in jail. They're hiding behind moats and armed guards and indoors and behind locks and peepholes and security systems and alarms and iron grill work on the window. And the criminals are out there running around free. Who is responsible? I could give you some names, I suppose, if I knew the names of some judges right here in Tyler. But in a way, are even they ultimately responsible? Because judges oftentimes are elected officials. And ultimately, in a society such as ours, the responsibility goes full circle, doesn't it? Right back to the people. How much are we willing to tolerate? How much are we willing to stand? Out in the Old West, I could cite the case like in Virginia City. Finally, 1, 2, 3, 4 murders a day. And in San Francisco, after the Great Fire, that was it. We're not going to stand anymore. And then, of course, they talk about how terrible the vigilance committees really were. But, oh boy, did they ever clean up crime. But, you know, they're corruptible, and so eventually political enemies. And sometimes somebody on the vigilance committee wanted to own somebody else's land. So he ends up dangling from a tree. And so it's imperfect, and there's no honesty. It starts out as a big need to correct a terrible problem and ends up as more corrupt than the corruption it tried to prevent. Same thing with labor unions. They started out because little children are standing ankle deep in sheep urine, in slaughterhouses and packing houses, the sweatshops, children and women in the United States way back in the teens and about the turn of the century that are being exploited. So we got violent fights, and like in Ludlow, Colorado, they shot down a bunch of people trying to unionize the coal mines up there. And there's a big monument, and little children were killed by militiamen with rifles. And there were fights. My uncle saw some of those. My father did, back in Chicago and in Iowa, when they were trying to first unionize all kinds of major industries in the United States. And the unionists would come in with billy clubs and baseball bats, and there were people who killed each other, trying at first to protect people from being exploited by crude, cruel bosses who can only think about making a dollar and not about the workplace or the conditions on the job or personal health or anything else. The wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceedeth. Almighty God is exactly the opposite of we human beings. He's always on time. He's always faithful. It says His mercy endureth forever. We know that He is perfect. We know that He is flawless, that He is honest, that He is trustworthy, that He gives total justice and judgment. We know that He is responsible. God came to know Abraham, and Abraham enjoyed a unique relationship in one way. Let's turn back to the book of Genesis, because God said, Abraham is my friend. And that would be something wonderful to have God say to any one of us. List your name and then say, oh, he's my friend. In the 18th chapter of Genesis, after Abraham came back and told Sarah that she'd laugh, because God said he was going to give them a child, he said in verse 14, is anything too hard for the Eternal? At the time appointed, he was going to do it on time, and he was going to keep his word, I will return unto thee. And he did. He was responsible, according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. And Sarah, excuse me, stepped on the cord. Sarah denied, saying, I laughed not, because she was afraid. Well, it shows her motive, but she lied. But it shows people under fear will lie, and her embarrassment and chagrin, so on. So she lied. No, you did laugh, he told her. And the men rose up from thence and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way. And the Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? Verse 19 is what I wanted to come to. For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Eternal, to do justice and judgment, that the Eternal may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him. Now there is the ultimate delegation of responsibility. God wasn't going to interfere and insist, and by miracles, and by grabbing up Isaac and chastising him or blinding him like he did Saul to change him into a converted apostle and make him into Paul. He left the responsibility in the hands of Abraham, and he said, I know him. He'll train his children, and his children will keep my ways. Abraham was completely and totally responsible. God's law was so perfect, turning to Exodus 21, right after the giving of the Ten Commandments, that when Moses came back down from the mount, his face actually shone. It was so blinding and bright that they had to put a veil over his face because the Israelites couldn't look into his eyes because this was such a good law. Look at just a few elements of this law. In chapter 21, verse 22, if two men fight, and there's a pregnant lady there, and she gets hurt, and she has a miscarriage, but nobody does anything, no mischief follows, there's no evil, whatever, thing that happens as a result. He shall surely be punished, according as the woman's husband will lay upon him. That doesn't say he can kill him, but it says he can sure come close. Now think about that for a minute, about the justice. A judge was trying something new. It was quoted on Good Morning America the other day. Up in Seattle, Washington, he was forcing drunk drivers who had been guilty of taking a life by accident, but when they were drunk, to confront, to talk to listen to the loved ones of the victim. And the loved ones of the victim would look at him and, you know, why did you do this? You don't realize what it meant to me. And it's a wonderful idea. It goes part way. It's edging toward this law right here. But look how many thousands of years ago God put in place a perfect law. He will punish him as the offended party shall lay on him. Okay, you're going to work for me for one solid year. Or, if it pleases him, you're going to go over there to the post, and I'm going to tie you up, and I'm going to beat your back bloody until you faint and you're senseless. And with every lash, I'm going to talk to you about the fact that I lost my son or I lost my daughter. That you caused my wife, because of your foolish fight, to lose our child we've been praying for all these years. When it's over, the stripes or the lashes heal, or the work is done and the guy goes on his way, but there's no prison involved, there's no huge tax drain on the society, there aren't a bunch of rotten, filthy thugs with a drug-laden environment of sodomy and perversion, killing one another with everything from a pencil up the nose to a homemade knife in the back, at the rate of I don't know how many murders a year in the Texas prison system, which is probably one of the corrupt prison systems in the United States today. It doesn't happen that way. So what do? They save billions of dollars, and instead of taking cheap crooks and making them terrible professional crooks, instead of taking a guy who gets busted for possession of narcotics and put him in with murderers and criminals, and then have him raped in prison And I don't want to get so brutal that it makes you sick, but you better face what goes on in society. Then he comes back out, and what is he? Well, he's probably a hardened brute that has no more conscience, that would kill people at the drop of a hat, that isn't worth trying to inculcate or rather to put back in society or absorb into society. If any mischief follow, verse 23, if it goes to that point, you shall give life for life. Somebody dies, they die. Eye for an eye. Somebody gouges out an eye, gouge out his eye. Tooth for tooth. Hand for hand. Foot for foot. Burning for burning. Wound for wound. Stripe for stripe. Notice in verse 28, something maybe a little easier to understand for a lot of people. If an ox gore a man or a woman that they die, now you're looking at an agrarian society, farmers, people that have oxen or cattle or wild bulls and whatnot, then the ox shall be surely stoned. A lot of people think it's terrible to put a beast to death. A dog attacked and ripped up. A child, recently, someone close to us we knew about, I think it was a child, or a younger member of the family anyway, they were trying to pull this dog off, and the owner of the dog was just really distraught. Of course, they take it down and check it for rabies, and the person has to go through rabies shop just in case and all that. But the disfigurement is there. But God says, no, you don't have to have all this great big heartfelt emotion about an animal. I don't care what kind of a pet that was for you. If you killed your neighbor, you take rock and stone the beast to death. But his flesh shall not be eaten. Nobody benefits from the death of the animal. You lose the animal. You don't just kill him by rocking him to death and then go out and enjoy the steak. You just kill him. But the owner of the ox shall be quit. But if the ox were known to push with his horn in time past, he had a reputation in the neighborhood for being a wild ox, dangerous for people to get in there, and it has been testified to his owner. The neighbor said, hey, you know, he almost hurt me the other day, or he chased my kid the other day, or he chased me on my horse the other day, or he attacked me in my wagon the other day, and he has not kept him in. He wasn't responsible. But that he has killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner shall be put to death. Now, apply that to an automobile. An ox is a beast of burden. You can plow behind him, you can ride him, you can have him pull a dray or a carriage or a wagon. Apply it to an automobile. You've got a child, not an ox, who is a dangerous driver. He gets arrested and so on. You know that in God's law, the parent would be put to death if that kid went out and got drunk and killed somebody on the road? Just take this and broaden it on out and apply it. God's laws were tough, but boy, did they stop crime. And they made people responsible. They made them responsible for their children and responsible for their animals. They delegated that responsibility. They didn't absolve it. They didn't tell people to sit out there and there's only one human being responsible. We will give you the orders. You just follow them automatically. They just gave the delegation the responsibility and then you carried it out. Verse 30. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him. Whether he has gored a son or has gored a daughter, according to this judgment, shall it be done unto him. If the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, one of your hired laborers out in the field, male or female, he shall give it unto their masters 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. And it talks about if you dig a well or a pit, and don't cover it, and an animal falls in it, you got to make it good, give money to the owner of the beast, and the dead beast shall be his. And it goes on into really rather detailed arrangements of societal laws that showed who is ultimately responsible for what. Chapter 22. If a man steal an ox or a sheep and kill it and sell it, that's rustling for the hide and the meat, he shall restore 5 for one ox. He doesn't go to jail for 2 years. He doesn't go to prison. He restores 5 times. And 4 sheep for a sheep. Why the difference? 5 to 4? I don't know. Maybe just because the ox is more valuable and bigger, and the more valuable thing you take, the tougher it is to pay back. And a sheep is not quite so valuable, not quite so much a percentage of restitution. If a thief be found breaking up, breaking in, burgling, you know, entering, and be smitten that he die, there shall no blood be shed for him. If the sun be risen upon him, there shall be blood shed for him, for he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then shall he be sold for his theft. If he has nothing in his hand, he hasn't stolen anything. And he is sold as a bondservant, and the person gets some money back, and that guy goes as an indentured servant to work for somebody else. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be ox or ass or sheep, he shall restore double. Now, that's if it's alive. He restores double, because the guy gets his original ox or sheep or whatever back, and two more. If he kills it, he gets four more. So really ends up with three. So you'd almost hope you're going to steal it, you might as well kill it, because you end up a little better off, unless it was a prized breed that you really had been working with a long time. I won't belabor that, but sometime you ought to refresh your memory. If these laws were so great and so white and so beautiful, and they showed the devolvement of individual and personal responsibility in a farm or a ranch or in any given situation in a family, among a community of people living together, and where the ultimate responsibility lay, it would do us good to refresh our memory about that. Isaiah 59, verse 1, I won't read all of this, you know the chapter. And basically what I'm coming to is the fact that in our society, whether you're speaking of government, or you're talking about jurisprudence, or you're talking about criminal justice, or if you're talking about the United Nations and Gromyko and Reagan, this certainly is true when it says in verse 4, none calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. They hatch the adder's eggs and weave the spider's web. It shows that their webs will not become garments. Verse 6, they shall not cover themselves with their works. Their works are the works of iniquity, and the act of violence is in their hands. Their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of lawlessness or iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. That certainly is the way of government. The way of peace they know not, and there is no judgment, meaning correct decision-making, justice, in their goings. They have made them crooked paths. Whosoever goes therein shall not know peace. Therefore, and because the leaders are that way, is judgment far from us. Neither does justice overtake us. We wait for light. This coming November, the entire United States is going to wait for light. Everybody is excited about Reagan getting back in. I'm not. Not that I want Mondale, but I just happen to know that Reagan is not going to give the United States of America peace. That he's not going to prevent an economic collapse. He may, in fact, be the individual who unknowingly has sown the seeds for eventual economic collapse in these enormous deficits. Who am I to say? I'm not an economist. But I know what Bible prophecy says. And I know that in spite of a few good years of breathing space in the economy, that eventually the house of cards will all come down. I'm not going to lay that blame at the door of one man in the White House. I'm just saying there has never been in the White House a man capable of staving off that which is just natural according to the natural laws at work in carnal human nature, which is vanity, jealousy, lust, and greed. We wait for light, but behold obscurity. For brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope for the wall like the blind. You get up in a strange place in a motel. You got to go to the bathroom. You don't know where the bathroom is. How many times have you stumbled all over the place, falling, kicking something, fall over, and your wife wakes up, what's the matter? I'm sorry, I just kicked the table. What did you kick the table for? It was in my way. Where were you going? I was going to the bathroom. Why didn't you turn on the light? I didn't want to wake you up. No, you go on. We grope for the wall like the blind. We grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We're in desolate places. We roar like bears. That's the riots and the demonstrations and the complaints and all of that. We mourn sore like doves, and all of the women want their rights, and the gays want their rights, and the Chicanos want their rights. And I got a letter chastising me for saying a thing about the Democratic Convention out there in San Francisco. But if they didn't know what San Francisco was, why did they go there? And once going there, why did they appeal to the gays? It's not my fault. I didn't make the connection. The Democrats did. They could have gone to Dallas. There are probably a lot of cities that were begging them to have the convention there. They could have gone to Peoria, for pity's sake. Blue hair. Platoon, you know, they could have gone wherever they wanted to. For our transgressions are multiplied before thee, and our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us, and as for our iniquities, we know them. Verse 14, judgment is turned away backward, and justice stands afar off. You go and try to get justice in a small claims court or anything else and see if you agree with that statement or not. And these poor women that were being put on trial when they were the victims of a brutal crime. And they're made to feel like a slut or whatever, and everybody is getting their voyeuristic kicks out of what happened to this woman when she's beaten half to death, and of course her very being is violated, and it makes you so absolutely furious. My wife said I should have seen it. I don't know if I should have. I got a fairly good acquaintance with what went on from her version, but it would have made me so mad it probably kicked the television set and hurt my foot. And equity cannot enter. Truth faileth, and he that departeth from evil maketh himself a prey. Isn't that true of people who will try to live that kind of life, that he makes himself a victim? If you depart from evil, you try to be good in this society, good to your neighbor, good to your friend, and you end up being a victim. Now, that doesn't mean don't be good. It's just saying that shows how bad sometimes people are. I wanted to turn to part of Moses' song. I just want to take one quick look at that over in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 18, because he said some interesting things about forgetting our rock and what happens as a result. This is not just a song of elation or congratulations to the nation of Israel, but it is Moses' song as a kind of a warning, because he said in verse 29, I know that after my death you will utterly corrupt yourselves. Now, that's pretty hard words. That's like Paul to the Ephesian elders. I know that after my departing of your own selves, men shall arise to bring up, you know, leaders and to get a following after themselves. And turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger through the work of your hands. So he spoke all this song until they were entered. The entire 32nd chapter is what he said. I want to break into about verse 18. Of the rock that begat thee, thou art unmindful, and hast forgotten God that formed you. And when the Eternal saw it, he abhorred them because of the provoking of his sons and of his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be, for they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faithfulness. Look at the margin. I have a little marginal too. It is not the word faith, but faithfulness, meaning stolid, determined, staunch loyalty and responsibility. Faithfulness. They have moved me to jealousy with that which is not God, meaning their idols. They have provoked me to anger with their vanities, and I will move them to jealousy with those which are not a people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in mine anger and shall burn under the lowest part of Sheol, in this case in the Hebrew, hell, and shall consume the earth with her increase and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap mischiefs upon them. I will spend mine arrows upon them. They shall be burnt with hunger. It goes on to describe warfare, verse 25, and of course lack of harvest and wild beasts and poison serpents and disease epidemics and all the things they really don't want. Verse 26, I said I would scatter them into corners. I would make the remembrance of them to cease from among men, were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, lest they should say, our hand is high, and the Eternal has not done all this, and they should boast and say, we overcame Israel, we overcame the United States, we overcame God's people. He won't let that happen for them to take the credit. For they, Israel again, are a nation void of counsel, neither is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider how it's all going to end up, their latter end. How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them and the Eternal shut them up? You can read all of the rest of that. I won't bother, but it goes along until about verse 43. And then it says, Moses came and spake all the words of this song in the ears of the people, he and Hoshea, the son of Nun. And Moses made an end of speaking all these words to Israel, and he said, set your hearts unto all the words which I testify among you this day, which you shall command your children to observe to do, all the words of this law. For it is not a vain thing for you, because it is your life. It is your livelihood, it's your physical salvation, it's your protection, and through this thing ye shall prolong your days in the land whither you go over Jordan to possess it. Recently I heard a sad story about a man that I had reason to believe was becoming, and I believe did become, well, I know he became at least a millionaire, if not a multi-millionaire. He was very, very close in the work in a very high station. And the story was, it's a kind of a two-part story. One statement came from another source, but that one day his wife went out to him sitting by his backyard swimming pool, and he was sitting there kind of staring away. And she came up behind him and put her arm around him, and he looked at her and he said, "You know, I don't have a friend in the world." Here is a man with an enormous bank account, with properties, with lots of money, more money than you've ever seen before in your life. A man that was famous for buying low and selling high. A man who apparently made millions. Exactly how he made them, I can't comment in public, but he made millions. Now, he has told someone recently he has bleeding ulcers, and lots of them. He can't enjoy a good meal like you can. He is actually in danger of his life, and he is about exactly my age. I can go backpacking, go up and down mountains 10,400 to 12,600 feet. I can go up and hunt antelope and deer. I can put a pack on my back and stomp around at altitudes that would kill more than half the population of the United States. If I want to eat a steak, I can do that. If I want to get out and run or do things around where I live or go fishing, I can do that. I have good friends. I have a beautiful office building. I have a challenging, rewarding, interesting calling and a job. I'll be looking forward to going in there and doing some television this coming week and being excited about what I can do to get that telephone to ring and come in here and just get thrilled when I hear of how many people are calling and read some of these names that come in from all over the United States that are responding to this and write these articles that they read. Working on one now on Halloween that I want to highlight right away and get out a special letter about that and have that ready for this fall. Looking forward to the Feast of Tabernacles. I don't have ulcers. I can go to bed with my wife and sleep a full night's sleep. I was able to go to dinner last night with my sons all around me, and one of them whose birthday had been the day before, we put it off one day, and to have all of that camaraderie and joy of my children. But, you know, I haven't stolen anybody's money. I don't have but a fraction of what that man's got. He can buy and sell me 10 times a week. He lives in a home that my home could be tucked into one of his bathrooms, maybe. But he's sitting out there, doesn't have a friend in the world, and he's got bleeding ulcers. Now that really tells me something. Something about the fact that he may have been following a way of life that somehow even his mind, in his struggles and his battles and his plots and schemes and plans, have so poisoned that even caused the viscera and the various glands in his body to secrete certain juices, and he's done that to himself, I guess, so that he is a miserable man. Totally unhappy, and in jeopardy of losing his life in a very painful way, bleeding to death internally. And I don't have any of those problems. And then I look at the difference and I say, have I ever been guilty of envying that guy all of those millions? I sure don't envy the way he got them. But I mean, do I envy him that money? No, because that's not where it's at. That is not what I want out of this life. There's something I have wondered about, and people have asked me about. A lady at a campaign asked me about this just recently. It's found over in Revelation 19 and Revelation 20. And that was, how can, after all is said and done, and Jesus Christ is on the earth, these prophecies take place? How can it take place? I say that anyone can become, accustomed, or they can take for granted, they can become lackadaisical and slack about any system or order of things or regime or pattern of life or whatever. Best way I could explain it is by talking about your child growing up on the living room floor looking at a television set. But here's what I'm getting at. In the 19th chapter in verse 11, I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no man knew but he himself. He was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood. I mentioned that day before yesterday. He's going to say, "Here are my scars, where are yours?" And his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron. And he treads the winepress of the fierceness and the wrath of Almighty God. He has on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And it describes this great supper He calls out to the carrion eaters, come and gather together in flocks to eat the flesh of kings, etc. Verse 19, and I saw this super dictator, this beast, and the kings of the earth gathered together with their armies to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army. How do you understand that? Now, of course, that's a vast subject that perhaps deserves a separate sermon all by itself, as to the deception that Satan is working upon the minds of people, and this whole era of science fiction and Star Wars and motion pictures and television specials and the fascination with outer space and the idea there may be space invaders and electronic games and everything else that are programming people to believe that when these vast phenomena take place in heaven and when it is Christ himself intervening, that they will look like they're acting out a part of King Kong, that it's just some invading force. And they won't realize what it really is. They won't know whether it's nuclear weapons from some other source or lasers or space platforms or whatever. But they will be deceived and they will fight Jesus Christ at his coming. The beast is taken and the false prophet, and they are cast alive into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. And the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeded out of his mouth. And all the fowls were filled with their flesh. Now, in verse 4 of chapter 20, I saw thrones, and they sat upon them. And judgment, I'm going to substitute a word or to add a word, responsibility was given unto them. Judgment. It is now your time to decide. And I saw the lives of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, etc. They lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now, I want to stop right there for a moment. In the church, am I only responsible? Are you responsible to me? And I'm responsible for getting to a place of safety or getting into the kingdom of God. And you are to get back, where I can't see you, of me. And I'm to do the work that I have been called to do, and you're to get back of me, and you do what I tell you to do, and that's the end of the matter. Is that really the way it is? Well, it's the way about 70 to 100,000 people believe it is. It's the way 70 to 100,000 people accept it and live with it, work with it, and they work within those parameters and that understanding every single day. How are you, if you're a housewife, a young married man, an older man, retired man, elderly lady, going to decide if you're the judge and that rapist is in front of you? Or you're the judge and the ox has been known to gore, but now he's killed somebody's daughter. Stone the beast and stone the man. It says here Christ's very first activity when he comes back to this earth is to walk up to these strutting, pompous characters, one of them in a long robe with a mitre and making all sorts of funny signs with his hand, and just grab a big fistful of that stupid-looking dress he's wearing and grab a fistful of medals, necktie, and stiff collar of this great beast general and march them with their legs kicking in the air to the edge of a big limestone cliff in Jerusalem where there are flames and smoke billowing up, and just shove them over, watching their bodies go end over end and listening to their screams. That's the first thing he's going to do. Take a couple of filthy, pompous, egotistical, swelling, rotten, toadish human beings, one of whom thinks he's the Holy Father, and the other of whom thinks he's the great dictator, and he's going to kill them. Now, if a woman comes to you, would you receive your training by never making any decision in life? I mean, here's a woman with big, huge bruises, and her face is cut, and her body is bruised. Are you utterly, in your lifetime right now, above and beyond that little sneaky thought that might come into the back of your mind, I wonder if she invited it. I wonder if she enjoyed it. Or would you administer real justice? Whether you're male or female doesn't matter. Are you above sex? Are you above race? Are you above partisan spirit? Are you above all of these various special interests and these prejudices and these preconceived opinions that cloud and pervert justice? Would you be absolutely, fabulously honest in administering justice if you are to sit upon a throne. I have never understood how a people in the church for this latter day that are being taught as no other church, there's no other church except the Worldwide Church and the Church of God International, and maybe some little tiny groups here and there that are not quite with us that are independent, and I've got to include them, but that are really teaching that we are to become a member of God's family to inherit the very throne with Jesus Christ of government and rulership and what we've called the world tomorrow to characterize the program and so on. No other churches teach that. No other organizations teach that. The Baptists don't. The Episcopalians don't. None of them do. We know that governorship, that rulership, that judgment and decision-making is in the future. I can't understand how it is that the very church which emphasizes that can enforce upon its followers that they be anonymous, that they be zombies, that they be so many yellow pencils, that others do their thinking and decision-making for them, and that they do not ultimately have a personal responsibility, even the responsibility to continually check up on, to know what their leaders are doing, the responsibility to see what Christ is doing, look around the leader and make sure Christ is still up there ahead of him, and never to blind their eyes and get confused between Christ and a man. How can we take that responsibility if we're not learning it right now today? In every way, in the Church of God, there is an outlet. Let's say there's an avenue, there's an opportunity for you to take individual and personal responsibility. I've never understood, and maybe it's a pet peeve of mine that I shouldn't voice, why many people simply don't attend church. And I have taken issue with those, by the way, who preach scathing sermons against people who aren't here. That doesn't make a bit of sense. So if I mention people who aren't here, I better do it very quickly. First time I've done it in 6 years. I don't go along with that, and the only way I could know your eyes are open in prayer is you know how. So it's real difficult to say, I think your eyes are open during prayer. And I don't like to preach against people that aren't here. But to me, it's a personal insult. And I take it personally as an insult because I think that's the way it's meant. To me, if you were having an occasion and it were a church or whatever, and I were working right with you, or I'm your close friend, or maybe I'm your buddy otherwise, I would be there. Let me tell you why I would be. I would be there in support of you if I had no other motive which would take me there and say, I need to occupy a seat, I need to be there. It's because I would want to support my friend and let others say, I'm here too, just by my presence. I accept a responsibility, and I meet that responsibility, and I go there, and there I am. If everybody in this work here in Tyler, and in within reasonable driving distance of this work, who might in some way be connected with it or benefit from it or be a part of it, were here every Sabbath, we'd have standing room only. We'd have a much better service, better song service, more interest, more conversation, more excitement. We could organize more things. We could do more things together. Where are they? You know, because the law is slack, people begin to just take it easy and just let down. I don't want to go to the extreme of no responsibility at all, of no law, no order. But neither, as you hear me loud and clear, do I want to go to the extreme of a vertical dictatorship and too much, you know, restriction. We've got to find that knife's edge of balance somewhere in between. But in God's church, surely, with regard to what Mr. Dart spoke about last week, I heard about it and we discussed it, but I didn't hear, of course, the tape yet, but I will, about festival attendance and accepting that responsibility. Go there and be there for the sake of your brethren. If you don't respect yourself enough and your relationship with you and God, go there and accept that responsibility to be part of what is going on. The same thing here in Tyler, in services, or wherever we are in God's work. If we are not responsible, God is never going to give us any responsibility.